Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks for subscribing, downloading, rating. As always, we do appreciate it. Let people know about the programme because it makes us happy. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about the atmospheres of exoplanets. Would you believe it was only in the 1990s that we discovered any planet beyond our solar system? And since then, we've found thousands. And the question is, what can we actually get from these planets, apart from their size and their distance away from us? Turns out quite a bit. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from the University of Galway, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. Our first story, Shane, has to do with spinal injuries.
That's right. Yes. And a new device that's helping people that have spinal injuries. So a lot of people get them. They fall, you know, they damage their neck, etc. And they can sever the connection between brain and body. And that can have dramatic effect, as you might imagine. This is a new device. And I read about it in Nature Medicine, and it's coming out of Washington, Seattle. It's called ARC-X. It's an external device, which is always handy, and it uses electrodes that are placed on the skin near the part of the spine where the damage has happened. And what they've been able to do is apply electrical signals and basically help to recover the damaged area. So they're in most spinal injuries, it isn't completely severed. So there's still some weak connection between the brain and the part of body that you want to move, your arms or legs, etc. What this does is basically boost the signal. So it helps. It's enough of a boost for your brain to start to get things going again. And not only are they able to do these small but very meaningful changes, the benefits are accumulating with time. So I think that's incredible. So the body's almost like relearning through rewiring to get people going again. Now, in the study, 60 people completed the trial, which is quite a bit for a study like this. 45 of them said that they had increased strength and function, and 52 of them said they had an increased quality of life. That's incredible, you know. So if you've had a life-altering injury, being able to use your hands to some extent or use your feet might mean you're able to live independently. It might mean that you have some degree of control over the environment around you. That could be profound for somebody who otherwise may have a life-limiting disease or condition. So this study is extremely interesting. And I guess that if they're publishing this in Nature Medicine, it might be the first of a whole new suite of technology that we might see being used for people in these conditions.
This is really exciting. And of course, you know, it's not a complete cure for a cure severing of the spinal cord. But if people heard the documentary that we did with Mark Pollock a few years back, one at New York, really, really fascinating story about Mark Pollock's attempt to walk again. They were talking about this exact thing. And he was a clinical patient trying to work out if these technologies might actually work to boost the signal that come from the brain to sort of skip across to the part of the spine where they need to do and bridge the gap of that injury. Is this the first in a line of products, do we know? And what sort of level of improvement might we expect from future devices?
Well, it seems to be the first of its sort that's doing this type of thing. I imagine what's very challenging in a study like this is getting the electrode to apply the electrical force in exactly the place that you want it to, and not to interfere with other nerves that are there. So that if you want to start using your right hand, that it doesn't start, like, you know, doing something completely different, and you have involuntary, like you can't control what's happening.
Yeah.
So the specificity here would be crucially important. And so I imagine it's a combination of the materials and the electronics within these devices that's giving these results. But as I say, it's in Nature Medicine, and it's a massive study that's going on in the US, public-private type of study. I imagine it is the first of many that we will see in coming years.
Really, really exciting, and particularly for those who are living with the sort of injury who've been waiting for some sort of a treatment for this dire medical and unmet need. Our second story, Jessamine, has to do with testicles.
That's right. And microplastics, which at this point are pretty much everywhere, But there is a new study out of the University of New Mexico, go Lobos, which is about looking for microplastics in both human and dog testicles. So in this study, what they did is they had 23 different human testes and about 47 from pet dogs. And they looked in each of these testicles for different types of microplastics. They were looking for 12 different types overall, including like PVC, PET, the types that we'd have in like water bottles, you know, food containers, things like that. And they found microplastics in every single testicle, every single one, to varying degrees. There were more in the human ones than in the dog ones, but it really just shows you how ubiquitous these are at this point and how difficult it is going to be to figure out what the impact of that is. The lead scientist in the study talked about how he wasn't sure that microplastics would be able to get into the human reproductive system. But actually, there were studies back in 2002 and actually earlier this year that have found microplastics in breast milk. They found it in placentas. It's been found in human blood. So it's really clear that the way that we live now, microplastics are getting into basically everything. And even if you want to try to avoid them, like they're in water supply, they're in so many things. And we're only just starting to figure out what the health ramifications of this are. In this study, they talked about, like, could this be linked to overall there has been a decline in, like, human sperm count over the last few decades? And they're like, well, maybe the microplastics could be connected to that. It's not really clear.
It also could be, lowering maths quality in schools.
Yes, exactly. It could be related to more
like they
tornadoes.
Can't count. No. As high.
I was wondering why this obtuse
it was a bad joke.
Is coming in.
So how does plastic get into the testicles?
Well, I mean, most of it is probably coming in through like things that we're eating and drinking, which are then just slowly passing into other parts of the body, right? And this the thing that's interesting is it's cumulative over time, right? And I think that's what was really interesting about the placenta study, which just came out in February of this year, is that like the placenta is an organ that only grows in about 8 months and then it's gone. You get rid of it. So the fact that there are microplastics even in that is kind of shocking. And, you know, like turnover of cells in testicles is quite high as well. The fact that there's microplastics accumulating there anyway, pretty alarming. But I think it's obviously pretty soon to actually draw direct connections to different medical things that people might be dealing with. But that's obviously going to be a really active research area as we learn more about this.
I know you're not a medical doctor. You're a doctor of...
A real doctor.
Physics, which whatever. Tends to be medicine.
But how do you get the plastic out of these? I mean, like, these people obviously found out that they had plastic in the testes, knowing that, even though it might be applied to all of us, knowing that there's plastic specifically in your testes, is there a way of getting them out?
Well, I should specify that in this case, the human testes that were used were removed in a post-mortem examination.
Okay.
So those people weren't, you know, then given the knowledge that they had a lot of microplastics and what should they do next. Like, their consideration of that was over.
Okay.
That was the least of their concerns at this point.
Okay. All my jokes, now that they're dead, are gone. So I'm going to move on to the next story. Our third story has to do with Mars Rover.
Yeah, we're getting there, right? Meant to go in 2018, now slated for 2028. A couple of little things got in the way, like COVID and a war. But the European Space Agency are doing it. They're going to send a mission to Mars. It'll have a little rover on it called Rosalind Franklin, which is pretty cool. And essential to its success is keeping things warm, right? So all of these things have a lot of electronics in them. Now, if they can unfurl a solar panel, then Bob's your uncle. You know, it'll warm up and it'll do its job. But some parts don't have solar panels. So, for example, the little garage that the rover has to park in, right? So it's what lands on the surface of Mars. It doesn't have a solar panel on it. So it needs enough warmth within it to sustain itself. And typically, space agencies have used radioactive materials, most notably plutonium. That's how the Voyager mission is still alive, if you will. In this story, what they're using is a different radioactive material, americium, which is more commonly found, right? You're not going to dig it up in your back garden. The only place at home where you find americium is your smoke alarm. Did you know that there's a small amount of radioactive material in your smoke alarm?
I did not know that, no.
Yeah, but it's there and it's okay. That's the main thing. So it decays, it produces heat as it decays, and that's enough to keep the electronics in a tip-top condition. The surface of Mars, it can be incredibly cold, and electronics don't work very well if it's very cold or very hot, so they have to keep it in the Goldilocks zone, and that's what the americium adds.
So is there a contraption that converts like radioactive decay into heat, or is it just like a hot pebble that never goes cold?
All radioactivity produces heat, and that heat is used to boil water, which creates steam, which turns turbines and fuels nuclear power plants. That's how it works.
Right, it's but they don't have, they haven't got a nuclear power plant on this rover.
Well, effectively, no, it's not a nuclear power plant, but it's natural radioactive decay which will produce heat. Yes.
Yeah, but what I mean is, are they by boiling water making steam? Are they doing that?
No. It's just a byproduct of the reaction, of the nuclear reaction, as opposed to a chemical reaction.
So it's like a hot pocket or something, you know, like skiers have that is.
Yeah.
And it just stays warm.
Yeah, and I wouldn't recommend using it if skiing, Jonathan, but, you know.
Otherwise, I might have more than plastic in my testes.
Yeah, exactly.
our final story, Jessamine, has to do with dancing.
Yeah, this is a really hard-hitting science story because science has now determined the best songs to dance to, but which is actually really interesting, right? Because dancing is a universal human behavior. Like, pretty much every culture in the world dances. Babies dance. Like, everybody dances. And scientists...
My wife doesn't dance.
Well, she
with
probably...
You.
Oh, won't touch that. But scientists from Aix-Marseille University in France did a study where they wanted to look at how syncopation affects whether people want to dance and what parts of their brain are involved with that desire. So syncopation in music is effectively the variance from the straight beat, right? So if you have something like ba 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 ba, that's not syncopated, but like ba 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 ba, like if you're blue and you don't know where to go to, that's a very relevant example of syncopation from 70 years ago.
Cinnamon on the Ritz.
There, we got there. So in this study, what they did is they had about 60 participants and they asked them to listen to 12 melodies that they had come up with for the purpose of the study that had varying levels of syncopation. So from very, very rigid beat structure to something that's more loosey, more jazz. The main
like
beat,
scat.
Yeah, exactly. Something that had
Please
a
don't scat. I did.
I was so close. I was so close to scatting on this program, which is not a sentence you'll hear me say in any other context.
Well, maybe you will later. But they kept the main beat the same across these 12 melodies, so it was always 2 hertz, which is about like 2 beats per second, like ba ba ba. And they had the participants rate how much they wanted to dance versus the syncopation level. And they found that basically stuff that's like a very straight beat, people don't really want to dance to. Stuff that has a very all-over-the-place beat, and maybe you've had this experience yourselves, like you don't really know how to dance to it. You're like, I know this is interesting, but I can't quite engage. And if this was all the study was, I'd be like, wow, that's not a lot of science. And they found, though, that when people were asked to tap their fingers to the beat, they tracked that main beat, that 2 hertz wave, and not the syncopation that was added on. So from here, they went to looking at pictures of their brains, right? So they used magnetoencephalography, which is looking at the magnetic fields that are made by different parts of the brain to try to figure out what parts of the brain are engaged in the music piece of this, as well as the desire to dance, which they called the groove rating, which I can't believe that there's a science paper that has something called groove rating. But moving on, basically, they found that the auditory cortex, and this is no surprise, that's what's following the melody and the rhythm, the part that has the syncopation. But it's the dorsal auditory pathway, which is basically connecting the auditory cortex into different movement areas in the brain that's following that beat. So basically, if that pathway is lit up in these images, that's where your brain is trying to predict the beat, and it's giving you that kind of impulse to move your body. So that's where that kind of intermediate level of syncopation is causing people to want to dance. And this is interesting in a way, too, because a lot of these brain studies looking at music or dance have looked at them separately. They haven't looked at them together. They're like, oh, it's an auditory thing or it's physical motion. Mm. But of course, they're connected, and like they're connected in most people, except apparently Jonathan's wife. And that kind of implies that when we do these brain studies, we shouldn't necessarily be looking at music and dance as two separate things. They are connected, and they're connected in how we think about them in our brains, most of us. Mm. So I am looking forward to further studies on this because it sounds extremely fun to be involved in.
I think scientists everywhere should explain this in detail at the next like party they're at, the next wedding. You know, just play
everybody
it all
stop.
Out
Let yeah, me just explain what's going on.
Did you know that the relation between syncopation and groove experience is actually
looking at this paper? Like, it is a very, very technical paper. It's kind of crazy. You know, looking at, you know, what makes us dance sounds like a real fluffy thing. There's a lot of data in this one.
We can ruin anything with data.
Jessamine, you are doing an improv show to tell people about climate science. Explain.
That's right. So, yeah, speaking of things that you can ruin with science and with performance, I'm helping to run a project that'll be performing all around Ireland next month in June called We Built the City on Rock and Coal. Yep, I got a thumbs up from Shane there on the title. I appreciate that. And it's about using comedy to talk about climate change. Because, you know, like, I'm sure we've talked about climate change loads on this show, right? It's very technical, it's very complicated, and it's very depressing. And sometimes it can feel like something that's kind of happening to us rather than something that we can do something about.
Yeah.
So working with scientists, but also comedians and performers, we wanted to put together a show that would look at these things in a more lighthearted way, but also get people involved.
Mm.
So we're visiting a bunch of rural communities in the west and north of Ireland. We're actually going to three islands as well, Inishbofin, Erinmore, and Rathlin Island, and a lot of smaller coastal, like rural communities, because, I mean, a lot of these communities are bearing the brunt of climate change,
yeah,
but not necessarily getting to do something about it. So
where can people go to find out more?
They can go to our website, webuiltthecity.ie, and our first show is just next week, May 30th, at the University of Galway in their Arts in Action program.
If you're doing improv, you should invite Shane. Shane's great at improv, aren't you, Shane?
Yes.
All right. thank you, Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. I am reluctant to age myself on national radio, but when I was a boy, there was literally no evidence of planets outside of our solar system. They were hypothesized, but we hadn't actually seen one. So it's incredible to think that today there are whole fields of research that have grown up around these extrasolar worlds. One such emerging field is exometeorology. And there are scientists right here in Ireland studying it, one of whom is my next guest. Professor Johanna Voss is assistant professor in the School of Physics at Trinity College. She joins me now. Johanna, this is a really interesting arena. We've kind of talked around it a lot on the program, but let's start off with that first idea that we actually didn't observe another planet directly until 1990-something. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. The very first exoplanet we discovered was found in 1995, which, you know, is less than 30 years ago. So it's really a very young field. I think a lot of people assumed that there were planets beyond our own, but it just took a lot of searches, a lot of failed searches, and eventually one of these searches yielded a planet. Fast forward to today, we now have about 6,000 exoplanets that we've discovered beyond our solar system. So it's really kind of exploded as a field.
And we are able to detect these planets by their orbit around stars, is that correct?
Yeah, so there's actually different ways of detecting exoplanets. So the vast majority of exoplanets have been actually discovered using indirect techniques, which means we haven't actually seen the planet. We've kind of seen its effect on its central star. So one of the techniques people may have heard of is called the transit method. It's when a planet kind of passes in front of its host star. When it passes in front of its host star, it causes the star to be slightly brighter during that transit. The type of exoplanets I'm interested in are actually called directly imaged exoplanets. And these are planets that we've, you know, taken an image of directly, which kind of sounds like the simplest method, right? Just take a picture of a planet. But it's really, really challenging because in your very best case scenario, your star is about a billion times brighter than your planet, which means, you know, your star can basically completely ruin your images. So it's very, very difficult to do this, but we've detected around 30 planets directly. And they provide us with really kind of powerful information about their atmospheres.
So does taking a photograph as opposed to inferring it, does that give you way more information about these sort of planets?
Yeah, exactly. So directly imaging planets, it's really powerful because it's the only method that gives you, you know, photons directly from your exoplanet atmosphere into your telescope. So if you can take images and spectra of these directly imaged exoplanets, it's providing you with really powerful information about kind of the physics of their atmospheres.
When we take those photographs, it's always against the backdrop of a sun. Is that right? We can't image exoplanets when they're not in front of a star. Is that correct?
No. So the small sample of directly imaged exoplanets, they're ever so slightly to the beside their host star. So they'll be, you know, the probably as wide apart as Jupiter is and further. So they're very widely orbiting planets compared to these transiting planets I spoke about earlier.
Why is that?
Basically because the closer you are to the star, it's harder to damp out that brightness from the star.
Right.
So we have all these techniques to try and like get rid of that light coming from the star, which will ruin our image. So the further away your planet is, the easier it is to take an actual photograph of it.
So these are millions of kilometers away, sometimes hundreds of millions of kilometers away.
Yeah, several light years, yeah.
Yeah. So presumably all we see is a dot. And yet we're talking about understanding the atmosphere and the makeup of these planets. How is that possible?
Yeah, that's a great question. So these objects, they're so far away that, you know, we say in astronomy talk, we kind of say we can't resolve them. And that means we can't kind of look at the planet and point out the North Pole and the South Pole and look for clouds. Any image we'll ever get of an exoplanet, it's always going to be smaller than a pixel on your camera, right? No matter what camera you use, whether it's, you know, the most amazing camera in space, it's always going to be smaller. But what we can do is leverage time to help us to kind of unravel what the surface looks like. If we stare at one of these exoplanets for, you know, 10 hours, 20 hours, that planet's rotating just like Earth rotates, just like Jupiter rotates. So as that planet rotates, if there's something in the atmosphere like a patchy cloud or maybe a hot spot, you can actually infer the presence of those features spatially by looking at that time resolution.
Really? So like hundreds of millions of kilometers away, you can identify hot spots. I mean, presumably not mountains, but you say clouds. You don't actually mean like clouds we see in the sky.
Yeah, so we find a large range of clouds in the atmospheres of these objects.
Wow.
The temperatures that we study, we kind of study this huge range. So at the very hottest end of the spectrum, the atmospheres have temperatures of maybe 2,200 Kelvin, which I guess is 1,900 degrees Celsius.
That's hot.
So really, really hot. Those clouds, and we can directly test this by looking at the spectra, and those clouds are made of things like magnesium silicates, which is sand on Earth, and molten iron make up the clouds in the atmosphere. And we can see those.
Wow.
But the very coldest objects we can study, I think the coldest object we've discovered is an isolated world. It's not orbiting a planet. But it has a temperature of about minus 25 degrees Celsius. So its clouds are probably made of, you know, water like we do have here on Earth. These types of worlds I'm talking about, they're not kind of rocky planets like Earth. They're all large gas giant planets. So they're similar size to Jupiter. You know, there's no kind of surface to stand on, right? So all we can see are clouds and things in the atmosphere. We're not going to see mountains or continents until we get better instruments to try and do that.
So if we can see like clouds, could we get an idea of how fast these clouds are moving?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that we're really trying to research right now. You know, we can kind of detect the presence of these patchy clouds in the atmosphere. We can see them rotate in and out of view. But also, if you keep observing the same atmosphere over and over again, we see that those clouds themselves are evolving over time. So, you know, they're kind of very stormy, dramatic atmospheres that seem very, you know, lively.
In terms of the composition, you know, when it comes to looking at some of these images, you can use the sort of shift of light to infer some things about the atmosphere. Is that also the case if those planets are not against the backdrop of a sun or a star?
Yeah. So if we can take an image of a planet and we can, you know, separate it from the star's light, we can also take what's called a spectrum of a planet. So that's, you can measure the brightness at all of these different wavelengths. And the amazing thing about that is that every single component of an atmosphere, whether it's a molecule like water or methane or carbon monoxide or a particular cloud species like these magnesium silicate or iron clouds I spoke about, they all leave a very special fingerprint in that spectrum. So we can get these beautiful spectra of these worlds, examine that spectrum and look for all of these components in the atmosphere, measure how much of them are there, and really get a detailed view of the atmosphere.
I know almost every interview about planets always comes back to life elsewhere, but and not to be that guy, but when we look at some of these planets and look at the spectra, is it possible to look at something that far away and identify something that might be technology or something that might be a definite sign of organic life?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, we're far away from doing that yet. But at the end of the day, it is why a lot of us are in this field. You know, most of us studying exoplanets, the big goal is to look for these signatures of life beyond our solar system. Thinking about trying to do this for the directly imaged planets, we are a bit far away because, as I said, the types of planets we can image right now are the gas giant planets. What you really want to do is be imaging the rocky world, right, where you can life could stand. And that will take time to get there. We just need, you know, we have this amazing telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope. We'll need even bigger, better telescopes in space to be able to image a rocky world. And once we do that, we're going to be using the same techniques to try and identify specific molecules in the atmosphere. And molecules, we can look for specific molecules, which we kind of call biosignatures. And they would be this signature. It's a specific molecule that can only be produced by life, or a specific combination of molecules. And again, we're really not there yet. So, you know, if you look at, you know, us here on Earth, obviously we all need oxygen to breathe. So you might think that oxygen is a great biosignature, but oxygen is produced on in lots of different ways. It doesn't definitely lead to life. So there's a lot of people trying to figure out, like, what is this special combination of molecules that we could look for that definitely points to life?
And just looking at the spectra would give us a sense of what molecules are in the atmosphere of a planet, again, millions of kilometers away.
Absolutely, yeah. So we just look for these special signatures in the spectrum. We can measure how much of each molecule is there, and we can try and, you know, create, we have very sophisticated models, so we can try and, you know, figure out what's going on in the atmosphere.
That's unbelievable when you think about it. So, you made a recent discovery to do with a brown dwarf. What is a brown dwarf?
So a brown dwarf is they're kind of mysterious objects. They have masses that lie somewhere between planets and stars. So they're a little bit more massive than a planet, but they're actually the same size as a planet, and they kind of act more like a planet, if that makes sense. So a star, like our sun, is constantly producing energy, producing heat, producing light. A brown dwarf is more like a planet in that it kind of just forms, and then it just kind of spends its whole life cooling down.
They're quite cold in comparison to stars, right?
Yeah, much colder than stars. So we can, you know, the brown dwarf in this discovery paper has a temperature of about 200 degrees Celsius.
Oh, wow.
So it's, you know, it's not, we wouldn't survive there, but we are getting down to temperatures that we kind of, you know, recognize. Really cook your pizza at this temperature, right?
Yeah. What did you find? Because this is to do with methane, and I'm wondering, why is that of interest to astronomers, that there's methane in the atmosphere of a brown dwarf?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we always knew that there was methane in the atmospheres of brown dwarfs and exoplanets. You know, we see it quite regularly. The unexpected thing in this paper was that we found a signature of methane that was emitting or glowing, in other words. So normally we just see methane in the atmosphere and it kind of absorbs some of our light, but this was glowing methane. And we, you know, it's not something we expected, and we didn't really know how to explain it for a long time.
Is it haunted?
Who knows? Maybe it is. So what we did was we spoke to people who study Jupiter, right? Because they see all sorts of crazy things in their spectra. But Jupiter's right beside us, so you can figure these things out. And as soon as they saw this glowing methane in our data, they were like, this may be caused by aurora.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we all saw oxygen and nitrogen glowing up in our upper atmosphere. What we think we've detected is glowing methane caused by aurora on this brown dwarf, you know, light years away.
Very cool. I didn't see shit, by the way.
Oh, no.
I took a photograph, but I didn't see nothing. excuse my language. The other thing about this brown dwarf is that it's like out in the middle of space, just being chill, right? It's not like it's not orbiting another a star. Mm-hmm. So how could it have an aurora?
Yeah. So again, that's another bit of a puzzle here. So. As you know, everyone in Ireland, everyone in Europe, I think, is an expert in aurora now. On Earth, when we see aurora, it's caused by these energetic particles from the sun kind of bombarding our upper atmosphere. In this case, there is no sun to be shooting these energetic particles at the brown dwarf. So again, we can actually look at Jupiter to try and explain what's happening, because Jupiter exhibits aurora as well. And it's only kind of partially affected by the sun. Its main auroral oval is driven by energetic particles coming from its moon Io. And so this moon is kind of shooting these energetic particles that drive the aurora. So potentially, I mean, you know, we've never found a moon or some sort of satellite around a brown dwarf before, but we can speculate that that might be what's causing these aurora.
Okay, so not snatching at straws, good hypotheses, but nothing quite solid just yet. Okay,
we've never discovered one of these, no.
One of the other interesting thing about this a brown dwarf is that it has temperature inversion. What is that, and why would anything have a temperature inversion?
Yeah, so we came up with this really nice model of the atmosphere. We were able to, you know, model it from top to bottom using our techniques and this beautiful data that we got from the James Webb Space Telescope. And to explain this glowing methane in the upper atmosphere, our model needed the top of the atmosphere to be quite hot. And that's what a temperature inversion is. So there's this patch at the top of the atmosphere that suddenly is hotter than everything below it. And we think that this is caused by all of these energetic particles are kind of supplying energy to the upper atmosphere. Hmm. And that's heating it up. And we do see these in other types of exoplanets, transiting exoplanets that are really close to their host star. But again, it's really not something we expected to see on an isolated world like this brown dwarf. So that was something that we didn't expect.
So this brown dwarf, does it have a moon that you've seen or no?
No, well, we just don't know. We have
Would that be really hard to see?
So hard to see, yeah. So these objects are so faint.
You'd have to squint really hard.
Basically, the equivalent of squinting the James Webb Space Telescope. So before this amazing telescope was launched, we'd never, ever had a spectrum of an object this cold before.
Wow.
So this is the first time we've ever seen them in any detail like this. To find then a satellite or a moon around that brown dwarf, we'd need really sensitive time-resolved observations to look like to look for a transit. So, you know, right now we look for planets transiting stars. To find one of these satellites, you're looking for kind of a satellite transiting a brown dwarf. So it really is a step up. But people are looking for them. So we think they probably are there. But we've yet to make a robust discovery of one yet.
And finally, just because we reported on it a couple of weeks ago, and it's kind of interesting, they found a number of stars that were giving off unusual infrared, and the hypothesis was that these could be Dyson spheres, which are like a theoretical structure that could be made by a civilization to harness the power of a star, right? Really science fiction stuff. But what did you make of that story?
To be honest, I'm not completely familiar with it, but I did kind of hear about it. And I think that jumping to conclusions like that, it's kind of hard to jump to a big conclusion like that based on, you know, not that much evidence. Maybe it's consistent with that, but it's probably consistent with lots of other things. And I guess from my perspective, you know, the more that I study the atmospheres of these worlds, the more I'm seeing that they're surprising us, you know, in every single wavelength we look at. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was some sort of just kind of an atmospheric phenomenon or another astrophysical phenomenon. You kind of have to go through all of the different options before you end up on it's a Dyson sphere, I think.
Irish astronomer says it's definitely Dyson spheres. Professor Johanna Voss, absolutely brilliant speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme. Really found that quite fascinating. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Thanks for subscribing, downloading, rating. As always, we do appreciate it. Let people know about the program because it makes us happy. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about the atmospheres of exoplanets. Would you believe it was only in the 1990s that we discovered any planet beyond our solar system? And since then, we've found thousands. And the question is, what can we actually get from these planets, apart from their size and their distance away from us? Turns out quite a bit. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from the University of Galway, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. Our first story, Shane, has to do with spinal injuries.
Hello.
Yo. She was great, wasn't she? We will definitely have Joanna on again. Really interesting stuff. That was brilliant. Really enjoyed that. Thank you. I've already thanked her. Maybe I'll just leave it, yeah. All right. Time to look at some of your comments from last week's programme. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me in studio. We were talking about how video games are helping stroke patients with Dr. John Krakauer.
That's actually not what the only comment is actually on. Well, we actually had a good few comments, but they were all like, that was great.
Okay. Do we have a comment? Where's the comment?
There should be. You haven't got the right page. There's a page that starts with texts. Did you lose it?
Don't be fucking blaming. You're always blaming me for stuff. And I gotta say, honest, most of the time you're right. But like every once in a while, I've got to hit jackpot.
That's weird.
Okay. Did you put it in intros, yeah?
I did, yeah. But you don't have the text bit there at all.
Okay, here we go. oh, yeah. Never heard of those names either. What's this? Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Pleistocene and the Mesozoic, you were saying in geological.
What are the names of the ones I didn't hear?
Oh, fuck. The Phanerozoic was one of them. That was.
Yeah. We were talking to Siobhan Power about the geological timescale, and it was really interesting, Aidan, wasn't it? Because while, of course, I had heard of Pangaea, and I knew that the plates moved around over time, I had really never thought about Ireland in this context. And some of the really interesting stuff that Siobhan was telling us is that Ireland was in Antarctica at one stage, and then it was a desert at another. And there was another interesting part that we didn't get to in the interview, that there's a place in Ireland that has two totally different land formations that come from completely different places in time.
Yeah, Siobhan was telling me that if you draw a line from Louth across, I think it goes kind of across to the Shannon Estuary. So it's kind of a diagonal down, I guess, towards kind of Limerick. Everything north of that comes from like the Arctic, like northern, where northern Canada is now. And everything south of that was the desert bit that she was talking about in the interview. It comes straight from a desert. And there was an ocean between the two of them. And over the course of time, they've just kind of slammed together.
Which is crazy because Ireland looks like, you know, a bit that's broken off from somewhere, not two small pieces that have stuck together over time. Like it looks like a whole piece.
Yeah, and I guess like a lot of countries, especially bigger countries, if our little tiny country has these two bits from random parts, every country must have like random bits of soil. I wish some ways, I don't have the patience to actually study it, but I kind of wish I was a geologist sometimes when you're walking on a hike and you're like, that's a weird looking rock. I wonder what that is.
My whole life, I'm looking at stuff going, I wonder what that is. I wish I knew something. I wish I knew something.
If only there was some way you could find out all these things.
I know, but actually the weird thing is, I know, like, somewhere in the deep recesses of my brain is the answer to nearly everything at this stage. I've been doing the program for nearly 14 years. I've had experts tell me about every single minutiae of the entire universe. I'm still a freaking idiot. Like, I still could fail any pub quiz, even in the science category. I don't know what happens. My brain is so porous.
How is that possible?
I don't know.
You should have the opposite problem. You should be like the whole time trying to stop from being the really annoying actually man.
No, I'm not. I have a friend who is that person already. Yeah. So that role
is taken.
Just
find other ways to be annoying.
I do. But we were speaking to Siobhan and Helena Tuberty. I was saying I'd never heard of the Phanerozoic.
Phanerozoic. Yeah, that's the, we're currently in it. Is that an era? It's in the era, I think.
See, this is, you had to remind me when it was out before we started recording because I didn't even remember that. Like, I held on to nothing.
Yeah, I think it follows, the Mesozoic is the dinosaurs and I think the Phanerozoic is the one we're in now.
Well, Helena is a fertility coach, which is an interesting one, interesting role. And she says, I've never heard of those names either. Amazing stuff. We were desert, moved from our rightful place. This is mad and brilliant. Love it. Excellent piece. Thank you. Yeah, I kind of feel like if we were a little bit more deserty, I'd kind of be into that.
Yeah. Particularly this week with the random return to winter for no apparent reason.
Yes, no, please. No, please. Yeah. Don't want it.
Yeah.
All right. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producer, and you for listening. Why not? We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.